Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Mary Lesh. Mary is the descendant of a fascinating individual by the name of Frank Francis O'Neill. He was the chief of police in Chicago, but he is probably best known to the world as one of the great historians of Irish folk music. Mary Lesh, With Respect. Mary, how are you this morning?
Very well.
Good, good. Mary, you're a resident now, here, both of here and in Chicago, as I recall.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
But one of your fascinations has been one of your ancestors.
That's true.
Who is that? Tell us about him.
Francis O'Neill. And Francis O'Neill is my great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. He came from a townland in Ireland called Trollybane, which is, you would call it, on the outskirts of Bantry, mm-hmm. which is in southern, southwestern Ireland, on the coast. And Francis O'Neill came from a large musical family. He was born in 1848, and that's right at the tail end of the famine. Mm-hmm. So a very bad, hard time in Ireland. His family were farmers and apparently did not suffer tremendous privations mm-hmm. during the famine. But Ireland was really depleted of opportunity and
people.
And people,
yeah.
Yes. Lots of just abandoned areas and whole towns.
Mm-hmm.
Being a younger son, he decided, he soon discovered there was no opportunity and made his way.
And that's because in Ireland, as is much of Europe, it was the oldest son who carried not only the burden of being the successor to the family, but also the successor to the family money and property.
That's true. So while the farm was prosperous and could support them all, there was no opportunity.
Yeah. So what did he do?
Well, he determined he was very interested, I guess we would say today, intellectually curious, and had pursued as much schooling as was available to him at that time. They were farmers in the poor old rural area. The country was really dominated by England, and which did not look favorably upon educating a farm boy mm-hmm. beyond the primary schools. So, but he was a quick learner apparently, and did quite well in school, and learned particularly in English, mm-hmm. Good writing skills and good math skills. And there is in his memoirs, he recalls a time he must have been good at sketching, because he's sketching a convent in Bantry.
Oh.
And the parish priest Canon Sheehan sees him and approaches, then approaches his family and says, "You should send this boy on to the Cork School of Design." Well, that was far beyond what they thought that their younger son should do.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually he...
And by the way, how many families say, "Oh, how can you make a living at drawing
That's
or
right.
art, Pablo Picasso?"
That's true. Well, he didn't turn out to be Pablo Picasso. So he went to Cork, which was the main city, and he had an introduction to the bishop and was going to teach in the Christian Brothers School. But lucky for me, he did not. He was late for the appointment and missed the bishop.
By how long? How long did he miss him?
Well, according to his memory, he is 15 minutes late. After quite a long walk of four or five miles out of the city to find him. So then he determined Cork was on the sea and it was a port, and he determined to be a teacher of English on the English ships. Well, that was a fanciful idea, apparently, for a Irish farm boy.
Yeah.
And the kindly captain did take him on as a seaman or steward, and took him to England.
Well, now, you know, here's a kid from the farm, mm-hmm. in rural Ireland, just after the famine, the place is depleted. He ends up trying to be a Christian brother, which, mm. now, that would have been kind of like a religious.
That's right.
And that meant no marriage, no, you know, all yes. that sort of thing,
yes.
and no descendants.
No descendants.
All right, well. So he comes up with this great idea that he is going to go on English ships and teach English? Good grief. What was the world that he found then?
Well, he went...
What was the reality?
Yes. The reality was a lot of hard work as a seaman. He goes to England, and he becomes a seaman, and he tells of his first adventure on a ship. And this ship is taking coal to Alexandria, Egypt. Mm-hmm. And you think, wow. My eyes were just wide open, and there was no good port, and they just kind of came up to Alexandria and were anchored offshore, you know, mm-hmm. like our beaches, mm-hmm. here. If a ship came along, they'd...
Well, and that's how back in the 1800s, mm-hmm. Ships here unloaded in many places for lumber, for example, for different things alongside. They just pulled out as close as they could without getting stuck in the sandbars. And
that's right.
And loaded and offloaded.
Yes. You can still see some evidences along our shore here,
mm-hmm.
of some ancient piers, mm-hmm. pilings that are still there. So he describes how they had to take the coal out of the holes. And then he... does tell about his mathematical prowess, and that he settles a dispute between the ship's captain and the agent on the shore about how much coal there was and how much should the pay be. And he talks about seeing some of the archaeological digs in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
And then he tells a story of... They go then to Odessa up in the Black Sea, and they have to pick up flaxseed to take back to England, and they have to take ballast to, you know, sail their ship.
Mm-hmm.
And the ballast is the remains or the results of the diggings,
wow.
The excavations in Egypt. He said you could see fragments of bones or teeth or, you know, really make out that these were parts of human beings,
mm-hmm.
Egyptians. And they get up to Russia. It tells of going through the Dardanelles, and it was very fascinating of that time. And he tells it with the wonder of a young person who's been on the farm, I guess I'd be just as wide-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
And when they get up to Odessa, then, of course, they let the ballast out. And he muses that perhaps reflects that what's going to happen in future times when they find the remains, these Egyptian remains,
in the Black Sea.
Right,
in the Black Sea. And they're going to say, ooh,
yes.
My God. Hey, the Egyptians were up here.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Confusing future
Well, you know, it's funny because it's something like when ocean-going ships come into the Great Lakes, they have brought in alien species.
Mm-hmm.
And so we now have inherited these in the Great Lakes. And some archaeologist in, you know, a million years from now is going to say, you see, they were there. They were native to that water.
Yes, yes. We all remember the alewife.
Now, you've been talking about his, you know, he says this, he says that, but where did you find all this? Is this all family memory, or did you find some other source?
Well, there are some, of course, family stories. I had never met Francis O'Neill. He died in 1936. My grandfather were wonderful storytellers,
mm-hmm.
and I think it was just passed down through the generations. Oral storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Francis O'Neill wrote down his memoir,
mm-hmm.
and we had part of it and kept it up here in our garage here in Harbert, and came upon it and were amazed. He had a story handwritten in his very beautiful penmanship, and of the story of building his first house in Chicago, and that was a really amazing story because my memory was just of having this very nice house in Hyde Park, of not
mm-hmm.
not a,
a shack.
Right.
Which
that's
is,
what
the
it was.
The shack was in a different part of town, right?
Right, right. It was in back of the yards
mm-hmm.
On Wallace, 2702 Wallace.
Now, between the time, first of all, these memoirs
you
wrote,
mm-hmm.
You found them in your garage?
We found a part of them in the garage. And then his daughter, he had a last surviving daughter, May O'Neill, and she was still alive. And when she understood that we had that, she said, oh, let me see. And like a story of in many families, and we never saw that part of the memoir again. But when she died, my cousin, Jim Mooney, found this wonderful type manuscript, which included the story, no longer handwritten, but it was the same story.
And who had typed it up, do you think?
I have no idea. There was no notation of who would have done that.
No, what was it? It was not just talking about the building of a house.
No, it was his, one way we like to say it was about his day job, growing up,
yeah.
and then life and his struggles to make it in Chicago or in the United States, which he was seemed to be thrilled to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And then his life in the Chicago Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
It alludes to his collecting music, but it doesn't dwell on that. And he's covered that. He published 9 books about Irish music.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them, 7 of them were really just books that just had almost completely devoted to just music.
Mm-hmm.
2 books described were more historical in certainly nonfiction, music and minstrels, and then folk music.
Mm-hmm.
And those books talk about the history of the Celtic music.
Well, let's go back for a minute to his that bit that you found part of in
mm-hmm.
in the garage.
Right.
You didn't leave it at that. You actually published it.
Well, eventually after we got the entire
mm-hmm.
Memoir, the typed version. We were approached by, we had a a foundation to preserve mm-hmm. and perpetuate what Francis O'Neill had accomplished with his music. He's fairly revered in Ireland because of all of his work in collecting and recording music. Up until this time, there were a few people who scholars who collected the music. Francis O'Neill is like the first and only person who was what you would call a layperson mm-hmm. in musical terms, loved the music, but had no real skill in terms of writing mm-hmm. music. He couldn't write music at all. But he could play music, and he had a wonderful ear, but he did not have that ability. I always think it's a wonderful lesson in life. Don't be deterred from your dream just because you lack a certain skill, because here was a man who published these 7 books filled with the Irish music, which, as Nicholas Carolyn, who was the director of the Irish Traditional Music Archive in Dublin, in other words, the keeper of the official.
Yeah.
And he described it this way, that Francis O'Neill took a snapshot, and I thought that was a wonderful way to describe mm-hmm. it, of what the music was like at that time. The music is always changing because it's...
People change.
Right.
Times
and
change.
This kind of music, if you've seen and heard it, is played in, I was going to say, community. 4 or 5 people, musicians, sit around and they say, oh, they'll play Kitty O'Toole, and they mm-hmm. all play their instruments. Mm-hmm. And a little jazz-like, they'll kind of take off and riff a little bit. But the music evolves.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly evolving. So this was a snapshot.
A snapshot in time.
Snapshot.
And this was would have been in the period from the late 1800s on through mid-1930s.
Right, right.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Mary Lesh, who is the co-editor of a book called Chief O'Neill's Sketchy Recollections of an Eventful Life in Chicago. And we're going to be talking to her more about his life, and then we're going to talk more about his role in saving Irish folk music. We'll be right back. We're now back with Mary Lesh, co-editor of Chief O'Neill's Sketchy Recollections of an Eventful Life in Chicago. Well, now, Mary, we got a little bit ahead of ourselves because we're talking about the Irish music, but I want to get back to this fellow's life. I mean, I read this book. It's absolutely fascinating. And it is a very simple style, but it's very persuasive. It's very... very clear. It's not flowery, and you know the writings of the 1800s tend to be a little bit. I always say that the English and English writers of that period thought that the semicolon gave them the permission to write 5 paragraphs without coming to a period. but this is different. It's a very persuasive style, very readable style, but. Here's this fellow. We last left him dumping Egyptian bones mm-hmm. in the Black Sea, and he goes on sailing for quite some time. He's not just a one-trip pony, as it were.
No, that's an exciting story in itself. At that point, which I didn't understand, I just never gave it much consideration. A seaman was like an indentured servant.
Mm-hmm.
You signed on to a ship. You never received your pay directly. The pay went to the boarding house keeper,
mm-hmm.
who bought supplies for you, bought your clothes, fed you, and you never saw the money, because it was felt that if you had the money, perhaps you'd have such a wonderful time, you'd never get back on the ship.
Yeah.
So they kept track of their seamen, their employees, in that kind of direct way. But Francis O'Neill's idea was to, there was somebody who was very interested in learning. He talks continually about books. He has books with him, and he's trying to find a job in England on the ship, and he's selling his prized books
mm-hmm.
Day by day, trying to get enough money to eat when he is taken as a seaman on these ships. After he sails through his first cruise back and forth to Egypt, he and another fellow seaman determine to leave that ship. They think that things aren't going to go well the next time, the next trip or cruise. And they go, they disguise themselves and go to Liverpool, where the feel they'll get a better ship. And their interest is to go around the world. It's not just to see, you know, one route.
Mm-hmm.
And the other fellow speaks five languages, and he gets a wonderful trip.
Mm-hmm.
Francis O'Neill doesn't get such a wonderful trip. He gets passage or taken on as crew on the Emerald Isle, which is going picking up refugees from Ireland and taking them to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
He's not very pleased, but he takes it, and he's thrilled then to be get to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he's not an immigrant because he was paid, to come to the United States. And on that ship, he meets his future wife, Anna Rogers, with whom he maintains contact. But once he gets to the United States, he has lots of American adventures and sailing up and down the coast and of the United States, sailing to Georgia. Then he gets onto the ship called the Minnehaha out of Boston. And the Minnehaha sails off to Yokohama.
Around the world.
And with a very cruel captain and with long stints at the helm. I guess you're supposed to be on the helm, according to Francis O'Neill, for 2 or 3 hours, but you were on the helm for 8 hours with this man. And then
wow.
He would find, you know, evidences of beatings of the helmsman when he took the helm. But fortunately, he says, reports that he never had that experience. And they go around Africa and up through the Indian Ocean, and they come upon a reef, and they hit the reef. And the captain, this cruel man, has a nervous breakdown and is
wow.
taken off the ship, and they have to They have divers come to, you know, inspect the ship and feel that it can go on. And they get to Yokohama. And he is trading. He tells of having sake. Someone gives him sake, and it's much too strong, and he has to sleep in the shop to be able to get back to the ship. And he tells of trading books, that he would tie the books onto his head in the harbor and swim to another ship where he knew somebody would want to trade books. And he does this without permission, puts the books on his head, swims out, and they come and get him, and they say, you know, you didn't have permission. You have to come back. And they go back, and then but he doesn't get to go back in the boat. He has to swim back. And they say, and there are sharks in the waters.
Oh, God.
So he had quite a punishment. Then he had to get up every morning and scrape the rigging.
You know, it's fascinating. I remember having a fascination for the books of O'Brien,
yeah.
who wrote
yes.
many interesting sailing mm-hmm. books about around the time of the Napoleonic mm-hmm. Wars. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, they made one of his books into a movie, sort of loosely, called Master and Commander.
Yes.
But one of the things I was fascinated by is how he described life on board ships. And whereas we think of it watching an Errol Flynn movie or, you know, swashbuckling yes. pirates and whatnot, I think O'Brien and this O'Neill fellow mm-hmm. Both pretty well capture that there were many, many, many hours of complete boredom, and that rather than people running around with cutlasses in their mouth, most of the time they were repairing things and the case of the seamen, maybe reading, the case of the captains, playing music, and so on and so forth. Anything to keep themselves busy. And was it somebody said life on board was filled with hours of total and complete boredom, punctuated by intense terror when they got into battle. And it was very short, but short periods of time. So the sailors of those days, maybe not even on a warship, he was not on a warship, but they had to cope with something to keep themselves busy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's also maybe it's a myth, maybe it's true, that the vast majority of the sailors were uneducated, just poor dolts, just drudges. But actually, because of things like the potato famine, when people had to flee, people of some education mm-hmm. had to flee Ireland or other places,
yes.
Many of those people were pretty had a good start and a good education and would find reading to be something that was treasured as a time to keep themselves from going crazy. So it is fascinating. Now, I'm going to jump forward. Your great-great-grandfather, Francis O'Neill, started off as a young student, wanted to be a teacher. That didn't work out. Was going to be a lay brother. That didn't work out. Went sailing for 4 or 5 years. Finally decided to settle down, and he settled down for a while in the West.
Right.
Became a cowboy, so to speak.
There's certain things that he talks about that haven't changed. And one, I just want to just jump back for one mm-hmm. second, is that he talks in the book of when he's sailing around to Yokohama and he's gone around Africa and they're watching for pirates. And they're watching for pirates in the same place.
The same place as
yes.
today.
I thought that was interesting. And then he goes to California. Well, we kind of skipped that one part that where he was shipwrecked.
There you go.
They go from Yokohama to the Baker Islands, or do they are in Honolulu. Those are, and they're in the same kind of maybe longitude. And they're going to harvest, or they're not going to harvest, they're going to pick up guano, and they're bringing some workers to work on the guano, which is a bird droppings,
dung.
And it was a terrific fertilizer, full of nutrients, and very popular. And two or three overseers. And a large wave, we would say today, a tsunami comes. There's no natural harbor. It's on this tiny island, the Baker Island, there is a drop of 540 feet or something. Terrific. So they tie off with big chains that are anchored to the deep anchors. You can't mm-hmm. drop your own anchor. How would you have enough rope to do that? And a large wave comes, and they're just affixing one of the lines, and it takes the boat and smashes it against the island, and all is lost. And mm-hmm. Francis O'Neill saves the monkey. on his head. But they, the captain and the officers are treated by the overseers of the island, you know, very comfortably. But the men, the seamen, that would include O'Neill, they're off, and they have to make do for themselves. And talks about the different birds and how they're not very good eating, but they eat a lot of fish. Then along comes a ship to pick them up. But in those, you know, and of course romantically, I'm thinking of, oh, and they're saved by the ship. Well, these ships were off for 3 or 4 weeks at a time, much smaller than boats that we think of today. Of course, they carried only enough food and water for their own crew, not for twice as many people.
Yeah.
So if you were saved, you might succumb anyway,
yeah,
because, of course, there'd be not enough provisions for
yes.
you.
Yes.
Well, fortunately, the boat that picked them up, the ship's musician only knew two songs. And Francis O'Neill had his whistle with him, and he taught the ship's musician, well, one of the songs, Yankee Doodle, which yeah. puts a smile on our American faces, and other songs. And for this service, the musician shared his food with Francis O'Neill. So when they landed in Honolulu, the people who walked off the boat were the captain and the officers of the Minnehaha and Francis O'Neill and the others.
And the rest couldn't.
No.
It's an amazing, amazing thing. We've had people on this show who have done some amazing things. Tanya Abbey was a sailor. She sailed around the world as an 18-year-old.
Wow.
By herself on a small sailing boat, solo sail. And she had to confront all of her worst fears, all of her happiness and all those things that you have when you're a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
She did by herself because it was there. It was
yes.
something that she wanted to do. Well, here you've got another fellow who, young man, he's
right.
you know, 18, 19,
yes.
20, 21, 22,
right.
and he's sailing around the world, no friends to start with. His family's back home, isolated from the world, and he piles experience on experience on experience,
mm-hmm.
and it develops
yes.
him. We're going to talk more about how it develops him after we take another break. We're talking to Mary Lesh, who is the co-editor and great-granddaughter of a book, of an author of a book called Chief O'Neill, Sketchy Recollections of an Eventful Life in Chicago. We'll be back in a minute. We're now back with Mary Lesh, resident of Harbor Country and also of Chicago, great-granddaughter of Chief Frank O'Neill of the Chicago Police Department. We've been talking, Mary, about the things that happened in Chief O'Neill's life
mm-hmm.
prior
yes.
to the time he came to the United States and to Chicago. But I'm going to short-circuit part of it because I want to get to his time in Chicago. But at one point, he became a herded sheep in
right.
the mountains in the west of the United States. He came to Chicago, worked in the stockyards. He built this home, which you started talking about, by scraps and chance and help and whatnot, as many of our ancestors did when they first came to the United States. I'm always reminded of, was it Roosevelt, who spoke to, I believe, the Daughters of the American Revolution, who, you know, sometimes those folks, not all of them realize that that we all are common. We have some common heritage. And so he addressed them as, began the address, "We immigrants." And that was kind of shocking. But he, in fact, was like all the rest of our people.
Yes.
Polish, Irish, German, Dutch, whatever. We immigrated, emigrated from our country and immigrated here.
Right.
Now, he got to Chicago. Now, in those days, Chicago was not the city, the civilized, cultured city that perhaps it is today, hopefully. It was a rough and tumble place. How did he get along?
Well, I get pretty much by his wits. Of course, being a seaman made him a pretty strong individual. So he did a lot of hard labor, but he was always looking to improve himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, worked on the railroads and with these sorts of different jobs. He tells of being able to build his first house, and he, you know, some of the bricks had come from the railroad. He arrived in Chicago right after the fire.
Mm-hmm. 1871.
1871, or right at the fire. So it's a sort of amazing to me. He doesn't talk about the fire, but I think it's a little akin to, if we could think of today, of living through a tragedy that was so obvious you would not even really talk about it,
mm-hmm.
except to say that the prices of the real estate went up
mm-hmm.
right after the fire, as everybody came to Chicago as they were rebuilding it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was lots of opportunity for work and so on, although not a lot for Irish immigrants at mm-hmm. that time.
But, well, go ahead.
Well, eventually, with some influence of the alderperson, Alderman Tracy, he was able to get a position on the police force.
And that led to a career that sort of made Chicago history, or at least he paralleled Chicago right. history at that time. Tell us about that.
Well, he was appointed as a probationary officer in the summer of 1873. And shortly after, within the month, he was chasing a burglar down Monroe Street. And the Pinkerton man, there were Pinkerton
private detectives
at that point. And he was going to shoot the man. And Francis O'Neill intervened and had his club and clubbed him. Hit him with his club, and but the man shot Francis O'Neill in the side, in his ribs, and they captured him. But that led to O'Neill being appointed as a permanent patrolman,
mm-hmm.
which was a promotion from mm-hmm. probationary,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that led to his rise within the department. Always an element of the importance of that very good early education he received in Ireland,
mm-hmm.
in with good math skills and with excellent writing skills and good penmanship. They weren't using a typewriter, and so the reports early in his career, he becomes the secretary who writes the reports.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you know, one of the things. All of those skills were things that he probably never planned on using in the way that he used them. I'm sure
right.
that when he started off in Ireland, he had absolutely no idea he was going to become a chief of police.
No.
In a rough and tumble city in America. But it turned out that all of those skills that he developed were used as tools to take advantage of opportunities that came to him and to find opportunities. But one of the things I was fascinated about as I was reading this book, and it's an extremely interesting read, was that Chicago's world at that time, the police, politicians, government, lawyers, business people, ordinary citizens keep coming in and out of this book, and they weave a pattern of a combination of great humanity with great corruption and political influence in the police department and personal vendettas, and how he survived in this world is like a man zigzagging through a minefield. But one of the things that ironically helped him to survive and to thrive was he got a reputation for honesty.
Yes.
And competence. And at the same time, loyalty to his department and loyalty to the law as they practiced it in those days. And he could swing a baton. I mean, when he had to, he'd get in and mix it up and in that crazy, crazy world.
Yes. And in Ireland, they have a statue in his honor. And I was rather surprised to see the statue. It's not very tall. It's not very big. And I think that he was not a big man in stature. But he had a lot of authority because of his character. Not his strength, but not... I pictured someone of 6'2", or something. Some big, strong fellow, and it wasn't.
Well, in going through his career in the police department, as he marched up, kind of zigzagged up from place to place, he ran into several situations in which he had a choice of either going along with a corrupt system or fighting it, or at least standing up to it. And at least as he relates it, pretty much most of the time he stood up to it. But even in his story, he will tell you the times that he found cute little ways, and we would say leprechaun ways, of dodging an unnecessary confrontation with a powerful enemy and working his way around it.
Well, that reminds me of the story he tells of the civic leaders getting together and determining that there was too much prostitution in one hotel. And what was he going to do about it? But he knew, of course, that some of these same people and their pals were customers of that famed hotel. So his solution was to put a uniformed policeman in the lobby. And anytime anyone came in, the policeman was to take out his notepad and pretend to write down. And within a week's time, the business had stopped.
Well, a funny story. My father, when he was not much older than Chief O'Neill, when he got started in the police, he was for a part-time job. He worked for a committee of, I think, the committee of the 11 or the 26 or something like that, which was Chicago produces these groups of businessmen and civic leaders who going to reform things. Well, he was an investigator for them, and he and his partner were assigned to go check out one of those houses or a series of those houses on the south side. And well, they were out in the car, and a car comes up behind them. And they thought instinctively, my dad said, they just figured this was not good. So he immediately leaned over in the car in the front seat because he was behind the driver's wheel, and the shots came in.
Oh, my.
And luckily, the cars were built more sturdily in those days. Otherwise, I wouldn't be around. But he then dragged out, he raced as fast as he could in the car. And he said, I never wanted to see a police officer nearly so much as I did that night. And nobody was around.
Racing through the city.
Well, but now we're going to – he had this remarkable career as famous. He was – I mean, cartoons in the various papers were drawn about his strength and his uncorruptibility. But and for anybody who's interested in early Chicago history, this is just absolutely fascinating. The people he ran into and dealt with. But and he was there at the Pullman strike.
Right.
He was there for not the Haymarket riot, but he was there for many different things. Arrested Emma Goldman, the famous anarchist.
Yes.
And on and on and on. It's a potpourri of American and Midwest history. It's just amazing. But let's now talk about that part of his life which is completely unrelated to the law enforcement aspect, but flows from the rest of his life, which is an interest in culture. And we talk now about his, what turned out to be, his saving of the heritage of Irish folk music. Tell us about how that happened.
Well, he came from a very musical family. His mother's name was O'Mahony. I think I'm not trying to give it the Irish pronunciation and failing. And he recalled, had a wonderful oral memory, and remembered 400 tunes that his mother sang to him. And this was the basis of his collection.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came to the United States and he realized so many famous musicians were coming, Irish musicians were emigrating here,
mm-hmm.
he would go to see them, or he'd hear a tune on the streetcar, and he would follow the person if the person was humming, or maybe he'd hear it out the window. You know, people's windows were open. It was a time when there were, the pictures of that time show crowds of people on the street all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, there's no air conditioning. All the windows are open. It's a much more communal experience, so you know you can hear things.
And like today, in some parts of cities, people would sit on their porches. And
yes.
that was their place to see people as they strode by. The socialization took place.
Yes. So the he was always noting down music and listening to it, and he could remember it. And eventually on the police force, he would be influential in trying to get musicians onto the force.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a sergeant, Sergeant James O'Neill, who was not a relation, could write music. And he would go back to the police force and he'd play the tune and James could
write
it down. After his son, he had 10 children. This is a very sad part of his life. And five die in what we would think of relative infancy. There was terrific cholera. There wasn't good sanitation. They lived in a poor part of Chicago at the time. When he had some success, he moved his family to what was considered, the suburbs, Hyde Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hyde Park was annexed to the city soon after he moved there, so he could actually live there.
Mm-hmm.
As today, you had to live within the city. He was always collecting the music, but then his son, a last surviving son, Rogers, who was a musician and part of his musical groups, died in 1904.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a terrible blow because then he had four daughters left and all of the other six children
had died.
And he, in deference to my great-grandmother, Anna, he stopped playing music in the house. This was quite a thing. So the music all reverted over to James O'Neill's house, which was a little farther west.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this part of his life. We're talking with Mary Lesh, who is the co-editor of a book on the life of Francis O'Neill, Recollections, Reminiscences of Life in Chicago by Francis O'Neill. We'll be back in a minute. We're now back with Mary Lesh, co-editor of a book of reminiscences by Chief Frank O'Neill of the Chicago Police Department about his life in America, life everywhere in the world, and also a little bit about his musical contribution to history. But his other works, his other volumes, tell more about that. This idea of saving the culture of Irish immigrants is fascinating to me, because there was a recent Chicago PBS program on Irish culture, yes. Irish music, and yes. he was heralded as the savior of yes. Irish music. Tell me about that in the time that we have left.
Well, this was someone who was a music lover, mm-hmm. but not someone who had education in music, and just loved it for what it was, and felt that Irish music particularly could help people express every or emotion known to man. And so when you had, and the in Ireland, the music is a part of life. I feel here in the United States, we compartmentalize music. Oh, I'm going to go to a concert. Mm-hmm. Well, they just have music for every part. There's always, they've always are carrying around their fiddle, their mm-hmm. Whistle, their borum. They just have that with them, or else they sing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that it's as interwoven into lives in America as it is. Maybe it's going to be with mm-hmm. the iPods, but as it is there in terms of a self-generation, a self-music box. So he wanted to capture that. All the time, too, we have to remember Francis O'Neill experienced, and his family, a suppression in Ireland. They suppressed the music there, the English did, and the church did too, didn't want the dancing. And they danced at the crossroads. Intricate, we would think of it, it's similar in many ways to our square dancing, or could see pattern dancing of the mm-hmm. early, 19th century here in mm-hmm. or in movies of Pride and Prejudice and so on. You see those pattern dances, mm-hmm. kind of a lot of similarities to that. So he felt that if he wrote this, collected this music that he could see was going to disappear. Yeah, I mean, he thought it was so wonderful to see it all here. Mm-hmm. He wrote it down, and that the people would love it. They could finally express it.
Mm-hmm.
And what a disappointment to him. They wanted jazz. They yeah. wanted to be American, like every immigrant yeah. wants to be American. And so did he. But
he wanted to preserve something of his past.
That's right. But he thought that once the Irish heard it, they'd love it. And yeah. that they should, he was very wrote that they should be having this music at their events, and they don't. They have
Jazz.
Well,
towards the end of his life, and that was in 1936, yes. by the time he finished his work and started to recollect about his life, he had produced how many books?
9 books.
One of them is his recollections, which you printed.
No, the 9 books of music.
Okay, 9 books of music.
Right.
And how many tunes, how many pieces of music did anybody ever count them?
Well, I think that they're, that's a whole topic for music scholars,
yeah.
Because there's a, I think they're duplications,
and
then is this really real or,
Yeah.
But they do, in the foreword of the book by Nicholas Carolyn, who was, as I mentioned before, is the director of the Irish Traditional Music Archive in Dublin. He does say that he changed Irish music forever by mm-hmm. collecting this and writing it down, and that influences are vast and every day. And instead of dying, which O'Neill was afraid it was going to happen, the influence of this music has spread, and is, you know, it's in, you know, U2. It's certainly in the Chieftains. And the big music out of Ireland is all, you know, based on.
On what he recollected and saved, which otherwise would have died.
Yes.
And therefore, as a protector of the culture, he is one, literally, of the great contributors to not just American Irish, but also Ireland's Irish.
Oh, yes, very much so.
And I recall in this documentary on PBS how they talked about the various people. And I think that one of the chieftains mentioned your great-great-grandfather. They talked about the statue that is in his memory. They talked about this great treasure that he preserved. And then when Irish music came back in the 50s, 60s, 70s in different forms, his influence was just was solid in that area, and so he had a great contribution. Well, I talk about my background, and I remember my mother, who was Irish, part Irish. I mean, she was all Irish. I mean, she descended from five generations of Irish Americans. But when we would go to bed at night, she would sing Irish songs.
Oh.
And that stuck in our collective brains. And to this day, I find myself, when I'm coming into the office in the morning or leaving it at night, humming or singing those things. I sing them in the car. I sing them. My daughter has had to put up with this. And I remember she was... we had this tradition of splitting the car radio when we were driving. One day it was her turn, one day it was mine. And when I would play opera and I would play detective Sherlock Holmes stories and Irish music. So Carrie put up with this. And finally, one day she was telling me that when they were in Ireland, she and her girlfriend were in Ireland, out in Galway, as I recall, and they went to a pub. And they started playing music, and Carrie was singing along. And her friend said, "Where did you learn that?" And she said, "My father, he drove me crazy with this. I had to listen to this everywhere."
Oh, that's a
but
great story.
She likes it. She does like it. Now, you didn't know your great-grandfather.
No.
But there's a point in here. There's a story about him being pushed around by two aldermen in Chicago, and he recollects that his daughter, Julia, was with him at the time, a 16-year-old. Was that your...
Grandmother.
Your grandmother. Did you ever talk to your grandmother about your grandfather, your great-grandfather?
I didn't. She died, I think, right as we were becoming particularly interested in... Mm-hmm. She was reticent to recall, I guess, painful memories. You know, she had lost all those siblings.
Mm-hmm.
But best source for what he was really like as a person was my aunt, Mary Wade, who's 100 years old and lives in Ocean Springs, Mississippi.
Went to school down there.
Did you? Yes. Mm-hmm. And Francis O'Neill had a house down there. Where he took his grandchildren, my father and my Aunt Mary, to get away from the typhoid that was epidemic and the influenza, the Spanish influenza.
A fascinating man, a fascinating career, a fascinating life, great times.
Yes.
Reading this story I mean, I love history. I love the law. I love law enforcement. I love the Irish. I love the Polish. I love all these different elements in Chicago and in the United States and in the world. And I sat there, and as I was going through it, and every string of my interest was tugged by this. So I found it a great book.
You know, can I interrupt for a second? We mentioned a couple of times you alluded to that program on public television in Chicago. And I must say, this is the historian that you see in that program is Ellen Skerritt, and that's the co-editor of this book.
Okay.
And Ellen's a wonderful, knowledgeable Chicago historian, and she, of course, brought all the history, and we led me in what research I did.
Good for you. We've been visiting with Mary Lesh, who is the co-editor with Ellen Skerritt of a book of reminiscences by Chief Frank O'Neill, Chicago police chief from 1900 to 1905, a figure of great prominence, not only in the history of Chicago, but in the world of Irish music. The name of our program is With Respect. We are on every Sunday morning at 11 and every Thursday morning at 10. Until next time, remember, if you show respect, respect will be shown to you.